Russian President Vladimir Putin warns the West not to send military aid to Ukraine.
Putin's comments in a TV interview that aired on Sunday come days after the US announced plans to deliver $700 million worth of security assistance for Ukraine.
Plus, the United Nations estimates that Ukraine is now one of the world's most heavily mined countries.
The State Emergency Service says it's not just roads and fields that are mined, but residential areas, cars, even cemeteries.
And later in the program, a look at the challenges of starting a new media company during a war. Today is Monday, June 6th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Russia's leader has warned the West against sending arms to Ukraine while Ukraine's capital of Kyiv is hit by missiles. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma starts us off.
Vladimir Putin's new warning to the West comes as his forces claim to have destroyed Western military supplies in their first airstrikes on Ukraine's capital in more than a month. The attack evidently shows Russia still has the capability and willingness to hit at Ukraine's heart, despite refocusing its efforts to capture territory in the East. Putin's comments in a TV interview that aired on Sunday come days after the US announced plans to deliver $700 million worth of security assistance for Ukraine. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And after making gains in recent days, the regional governor says Ukrainian fighters in the city of Severodonetsk have lost some ground to Russian forces. Earlier today, I spoke with reporter Anna Chernikova in Kyiv to learn more.
The situation in Severodonetsk is just changing every minute. I think that it's really difficult to say, you know, if it is now the same as it was an hour ago, for example. The information we had confirmed over the weekend that at one point Ukrainian forces actually got 50% of Severodonetsk back, and this was confirmed by the Ukrainian officials in Luhansk region. But again, the fightings are very tough. The fightings are very, very intensive, and we can see that it's very difficult in terms of, you know, physically and emotionally for both sides, but especially for Ukrainian side, because, of course, Russian forces just, well, they concentrated all of their resources there. And there are definitely more Russian forces there than Ukrainian forces. However, situation is not as bad as everyone expected, because at the end of last week, Severodonetsk was almost completely under Russian control. So what we know also that according to American Institute for War Studies, they say that Russian forces can still capture Severodonetsk and Lysychansk, but Ukraine defenses remain very strong in this area. And if Severodonetsk is now a battlefield, Lysychansk remains absolutely and completely under the Ukrainian control, and it's a city on the top of the hill. So in terms of operational positioning, it's a very good position for Ukrainian forces. We see that Ukrainian forces are trying to counterattack all the time, and they are quite successful. And also what military experts are saying that thanks to this counterattack, the successful counterattacks, Russian forces are starting to lose their enthusiasm in other directions. So Ukrainians are kind of using this to fight back in other different areas. It should be also noted that Russian troops have launched series of unsuccessful offensive operations southwest of Izum. It's not Luhansk region, but it's kind of going, you know, in line. So we can see that they're trying to capture Severodonetsk and try to, you know, move forward from Izum. But for the moment, they're not successful.
Anna, we've already heard how Russian President Vladimir Putin issued a warning to the West not to give additional military aid to Ukraine. But on Monday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky spoke with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who reaffirmed that his country was giving additional aid to Ukraine. What can you tell us about the aid that is coming from Britain?
British officials are going to send another aid, military aid to Ukraine. We're talking about multiple rocket launchers, which can hit targets up to 80 kilometers. And this makes Russian officials very nervous. However, this is one of the most important equipment that Ukrainian officials and Ukrainian military is asking for.
Anna, we have additional information on our website, voanews.com/flashpoint, about various hotspots around the country, including Mykolaiv and Kharkiv. But I wanted to ask you about the fighting that's taking place in and around Kherson, since we haven't mentioned that in a while.
Kherson region, as we know, was quite successful last week for Ukrainian soldiers as they started the, well, certain counterattack actions there. However, situation in the region is quite critical. So if we look in general, there, well, it's very difficult for civilians to stay there because there is lack of connection, lack of provision, medication, lack of money there. So in these terms, it's really, really complicated. Fightings are very, very difficult. Fightings, very active fightings continue because, of course, Russian forces are trying to get the liberated territories back. So we see that basically the forces, for the moment, the forces are staying at the line and fighting. So we don't have confirmed information that Ukrainian forces have moved further. But we know that there were a couple of successful operations and Ukrainians, according to, you know, to certain military experts, Ukrainians are trying to divide Russian forces in two parts to make it easier for Ukrainian forces to basically surround them.
Anna Chernikova is reporting for us from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
The United Nations estimates Ukraine is now one of the most mined countries in the world. In territories no longer occupied by Russia, pyrotechnicians are disarming hundreds of mines each day. Anna Rice narrates that story.
Ukrainian deminer Mykhailo Ilyev is clearing Russian mines in areas Ukraine has retaken in the northern part of the country. He says he's never seen this many mines.
We've already destroyed more than 21,000 explosive objects. Right now, we are clearing mines in villages the Russian army used to occupy so that people can safely and calmly return to their homes.
He and his team work from morning to evening, 7 days a week. His sapper dog, a Jack Russell Terrier named Patron, helps find the mines. The dog has become an international star and received an award from Ukrainian President Zelensky.
When the metal detector turns on, it beeps a certain signal. The dog concentrates on this, understands when the signal increases, hears when the detector gives the final signal, and then begins to dig.
Ilyev and his team are performing what they call operational demining, responding to reports of explosives called in by residents. The next stage is humanitarian demining, guaranteeing that an area is safe.
It is the much longer type of demining. The end result of humanitarian demining is the transfer of land back to its owner.
There are a few groups working in the region. In addition to the Ukrainian Deminers Association, there is the international group HALO.
HALO is already in Ukraine. We employed 430 people. We've been working there since 2016. So I went to visit my program and to see how we can adjust in the light of the current conflict. So we're moving really from working just in the Donbass to now working across the country.
The State Emergency Service says it's not just roads and fields that are mined, but residential areas, cars, even cemeteries. And HALO CEO James Cohen says they're finding all kinds of explosive materials.
What we're talking about here is, you know, a mix of landmines, air-delivered munitions, artillery shells, rocket shells, booby traps, lots of different things.
It's an expensive, dangerous, time-consuming process.
That's hundreds of billions of dollars, because cleaning a square meter of land costs about $3-4. The area where humanitarian demining is to be carried out is currently about 132,000 square kilometers.
The Ministry of Internal Affairs of Ukraine estimates that twice as much territory will need to be treated, and that it might take decades to fully demine Ukraine once the war is over. Олеся Бакалець in Washington, NRI's VOA News.
This past weekend, the war in Ukraine surpassed 100 days of conflict since Russia launched its invasion. Henry Ridgewell looks back at how the conflict has unfolded and how it has upended European security.
On February 24th, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced what he called a special military operation in Ukraine.
And for this, we will be striving for
In a televised address, he said, "We will strive to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine, and will bring to justice those who committed multiple bloody crimes against civilians, including Russian citizens." Explosions echoed across Kyiv. Russian tanks and armored vehicles began crossing the border. A sovereign European nation had been invaded, triggering the continent's worst conflict since 1945. U.S. President Joe Biden gave this reaction.
The Russian military has begun a brutal assault on the people of Ukraine. Without provocation, without justification, without necessity, this is a premeditated attack.
A 64-kilometer Russian armored column approached Kyiv from the north, but tactical mistakes saw the Russian advance on Kyiv stall as Ukraine's armed forces put up fierce resistance. By April, Russian forces were in retreat from the capital. They left behind scenes of horror. In towns like Bucha, advancing Ukrainian forces uncovered mass civilian graves. Russia claims the evidence was fabricated. Visiting Bucha, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said these are war crimes and they will be recognized by the world as genocide. The atrocities prompted NATO and Western countries to beef up their deployments in Eastern Europe and increase weapon supplies to Ukraine. The United States has so far pledged $53 billion in military, economic, and humanitarian aid. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg.
We agreed that we must further strengthen and sustain our support to Ukraine so that Ukraine prevails in the face of Russia's invasion.
Finland and Sweden, which for decades had remained neutral, applied to join NATO in the face of Russia's aggression. The war prompted a huge exodus of Ukrainian refugees, with some 6 million fleeing to neighbouring countries so far, and a further 8 million internally displaced within Ukraine. Afzal Ashraf is a professor of international affairs at Loughborough University.
The shelling of civilian areas and driving out large amounts of civilian populations may well be part of the Russian plan, because that serves them well.
Western sanctions tightened the economic noose on Russia, causing its currency to plummet. Facing mounting military losses, Russia redirected its forces to the eastern Donbass region. The strategic port of Mariupol was all but destroyed. Tens of thousands of civilians were killed. Fighting continues to rage in the east. The US is to begin sending long-range artillery to Ukraine, something Kyiv has long demanded. Bradley Bowman is from the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies in Washington, D.C.
If you combine Ukrainian bravery and skill and a willingness to defend their homes against this unprovoked invasion with Western support, which frankly we're going to have to be able to provide for the long haul, then I think over the long run, this will be a grand strategic disaster for Putin. But in the short term, let's be clear, the picture is mixed.
The conflict, 100 days old, has already upended European security. Peace talks hosted by Turkey are stalled. All sides are preparing for a long war. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You're You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. VOA Eastern Europe Bureau Chief Miroslava Gongadze recently sat down with Olga Rudenko. She's the editor-in-chief of the Kyiv Independent. Rudenko began their conversation by describing the organization's origin.
Well, it was a surreal moment, really, because when the war started, the Kyiv Independent was 3 months old. And we were sort of fighting a war of our own, because setting up a media outlet anywhere is challenging, but in Ukraine especially, with the kind of environment we have, with the kind of with how difficult it is to be sustainable as a media in Ukraine. So we were ready to fight like a very long and difficult uphill battle to survive as a media outlet in Ukraine. And then, as you said, boom, 3 months after we were founded, the war started, and we had to, you know, all the things we were worrying about, like how to find funds for our reporting, that totally didn't matter, because all that matters was that we're in this survival mode together with our country now. And because we are a local media outlet that publishes in English, we were in very high demand when the war started, because the world's eyes were on Ukraine. And our mission is to be the world's window into Ukraine, explaining Ukraine to the world, bringing the truth about Ukraine to the world. And of course, when there's a war happening and all eyes are on Ukraine, it matters more than ever. There's more attention than ever. And we felt huge responsibility for getting things right. We're Ukrainians. We are, most of us are Ukrainians or foreigners who have lived in Ukraine for a long time. So this story, this war is so personal to us. And what Ukraine and Ukrainians are going through is so personal to us. And we really wanted to kind of educate the world about how great Ukrainians are. Because those first days, you remember when resistance was so overwhelming to Russia, and you saw these videos of Ukrainians stopping Russian tanks with bare hands and so on. It was a story that we really wanted to tell the world. And we were doing that. So we suddenly jumped from being a media startup with challenges like finding money to a media startup in the times of the war with challenges like surviving physically, relocating or not relocating, making decisions like that. And suddenly we had millions of eyes on us. Before the war, we had 30,000 people following us on Twitter, and a couple of weeks into the war, it was 1 million, and then now it's 2 million people.
With the war and with the economy how it is right now, there's not enough money to fund, specifically fund media. And the issue of coverage, security, and censorship and self-censorship, that's the issue as well. How do you see this this media trend developing?
Yes, this is a question that I think about a lot, because Ukrainian journalists are in a very strange and unique relationship with the Ukrainian government right now. It has never happened before. We have never before been on one side with them, because now we are in a survival mode and we are all, you know, fighting against Russia in our own ways. But I also, you know, I have memory of what the relationship was like before the war, so I know that there were issues with the freedom of speech. I know that President Zelensky and his government have been vulnerable in terms of, they did not react well to criticism from the media. They did not take criticism well. And now the criticism is off. Nobody is scrutinizing in Ukraine what Zelensky is doing. Well, people do on social media, but you know, traditional media, it's not like there is a press conference where people grill Zelensky's questions, for example. So, as a journalist who's always, because I'm a journalist from Ukraine, I'm always in the mode of like staying vigilant about, is somebody trying to kill off my profession, you know? So as a journalist, it worries me in the sense that how I'm thinking about how the Ukrainian government is going to bounce back from this special mode that we are now in when Ukraine wins, and we you know, and the media will start scrutinizing authorities again, as they should, because this is our job.
How
would they handle it? Because you can't, you know, having like many months on end being praised internationally, like and deservingly for what Zelensky is doing now. He deserves the praise, but what would do to his, you know, perception of criticism, to his relationship with the media? I mean, he can't expect it to continue forever.
Senegal's president, Macky Sall, is the chairperson this year of the African Union, and he made a direct plea on Friday to Russian President Vladimir Putin to free up the blockade of Ukrainian wheat from the Black Sea ports so that the grain can reach African markets, reducing food prices, which have soared since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. While Ukrainian and European officials continue to discuss the situation, Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that Saul's decision to meet with Putin highlights the desperation many African countries are feeling right now.
I think the fact that President Saul was being very explicit about that draws an important level of attention, the serious side effects that are affecting Africa as a result of Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Some countries have been hurting more than others in Africa. Can you give us an idea of some of those countries with the food shortages?
It's a good point that the effects in Africa are not uniform. And countries that have been most affected are those who receive most of their grain from Ukraine and Russia. And so Egypt, Nigeria, Sudan, Tanzania, Senegal, Kenya, South Africa, those are the countries that have been most directly impacted globally, have increased on average about 33% from a year ago. And some places it's far higher than that. And so most every country in the world and in Africa have been affected. And of course, when people are already living near the margin, don't have a lot of disposable income, those increases in food prices, you know, affect how much people have to eat every day.
Do you think that Saul had any impact on Mr. Putin's frame of mind about this? And will it make a difference in where things stand right now with the grain coming out of Russia and Ukraine?
Well, I think it's too early to say. The Russians have attempted to put the food crisis as a result of Western sanctions rather than as a result of Russia's invasion and the blockading of the Ukrainian ports. And so I think on the one hand, you know, Russia's likely to just continue to use the crisis as a means of blaming the West. Now, the fact that the African delegation was so direct in appealing to Putin may open up a door, and it may give Russia an opportunity to present itself as a magnanimous international actor that, you know, will make allowances and special efforts to try and help, you know, Russia's African partners.
Do you think that Saul's pleading with Putin will change the minds of the international community about the sanctions?
So I think it's an important distinction to make, that while the Russians are trying to put the focus on the sanctions as the cause of the food shortages, that's really not the driver of what's happening. It's the Russian invasion, the Russian blockade of Ukrainian ports that is preventing that grain from getting out. The Western sanctions have explicitly not included grain from Russia.
So it's a false argument on Russia's part, you're saying?
That's right. That's right. They're trying to distract attention from the fact that Russia is the main driver of this spike in food prices.
That was the director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, Joseph Siegel, speaking to my colleague, Carol Van Dam. And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage, not only on Ukraine, but news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media feeds. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America, Washington, D.C. Z-T-C.